Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmyusa.com. This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring the intersection between food, agriculture, and competition. Learn how a chicken raising contest in the 1940s led to the poultry industry we have today.
And they were going to run a contest and try and develop what they would call the chicken of tomorrow.
We'll also venture into the world of agricultural video games, where a new set of tractors is making a lot of fans happy.
The biggest addition to 19 was the John Deere's. That's what everyone was hyped for.
And we pay a visit to a group of Indian restaurants that aren't on the friendliest of terms.
Usually they wait for my restaurant, but after long wait, they go to next door or downstairs. But this is how they do business. They completely copy whatever we do.
Embrace your competitive spirit and be the first to listen to new Meat and Three episodes by subscribing now. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Arvid Rosengren. We'll talk to Arvid about life after being the best sommelier in the world, wine, and a lot more. We'll taste a Vino Verde?
Vino Verde.
Vino Verde for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Swedish-born Arvid Rosengren was always intrigued with food as a kid, but not before putting nanotechnology behind him. We'll make him explain that. He honed his wine skills participating in sommelier competitions, winning Best Sommelier in Sweden in 2010, Best Sommelier in Europe in 2013, and ultimately rising to the Best Sommelier in the World in 2016. He made his way to the U.S. after many years on the Scandinavian and European restaurant scene. Arvid now is the wine director at Legacy Records in Hudson Yards, around Hudson Yards, part of the Delicious Hospitality Group. Arvid, welcome to the Grape Nation.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in. You have a very interesting background, and I want you to cover all the good stuff. I don't want you to dwell on it forever, but give everybody a little background on your journey in life and wine that really got you to two very important places. One is you just relinquished the best sommelier in the world. We'll talk about that. And you're the wine director, truly, you know, one of the hot restaurants and groups. So give us a little story.
Yeah. So I'll try not to dwell too long on many of the details. But I, as you said, I grew up in Sweden, in the south of Sweden. Not in a family where gastronomy played a huge part. We cooked at home as much as possible, but my parents split up when I was fairly young, and food was, you know, making good, nutritious food was a big deal to both of my parents, for me and my siblings. But it was never fancy. We didn't go out very much. But I was always intrigued by food and by the dining experience. So, you know, as an example, I, when I was 7 years old, my birthday wish list was to go and have sushi, which was at that point a very new thing.
Big deal, right?
Yeah. Big deal. It was one Japanese restaurant in my town in Sweden. They did not make sushi, but they made a sashimi. So that was, okay. I was happy. It was close.
Funny.
So, fine dining and wine was never a big part of it. I mean, there was wine occasionally at the table, but looking back on it, it was Co-op, Rioja, or that kind of thing. So nothing that was too fancy. But I probably tasted wine back to being, you know, young teens. But my dream was to be a chef when I was a kid. But I also did pretty well in school, and And the two aren't necessarily compatible in Europe. If you want to go down to the culinary school, you make that choice when you're 15, 16 years old. And I went a much more sort of general route studying.
But you have to get through your parents first, too. Exactly. I'm sure they blocked the chef thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, they would have supported that, too. Right. But I think they thought of it as a waste. So yeah, it was an uphill battle, and which I lost. And I ended up studying a lot of math, science, and I studied engineering towards nanotech or nanoscience engineering.
How does that come about? Is there an interest, or they put it in front of you and it looked good?
You know, I think at the time this was around sort of just after. It was around the year 2000, and it was just one of those hot terms that was being thrown around. So, and sort of the popular reading around it was cool. It was a bunch of cool applications. And I think halfway through that sort of education, 2-3 years in, I realized that the sort of practical application of what I thought was cool to read about would be me stuck in front of a computer screen or stuck in a lab coat, running simulations and looking at a microscope for the rest of my life. And I didn't realize at the time, but I took a break, which I guess I'm like I'm still a very long hiatus from that.
I would say so. Yeah. You're not a nanotechnologist.
No, definitely not. Right. But you know, the good thing is that gave me the basic sort of chops to be able to understand biology, chemistry, a little bit of physics. I can read. I can talk about the finer sort of technical points of winemaking and understand what people are talking about, and that's great. But I realized at the time that I needed to look for something else. I had worked in restaurants, and I had sort of honed my interest a little bit during my studies. It was a chance for me to meet with sort of some older, more sophisticated peers than my working class background people in my hometown where we.
You did work at McDonald's.
I did work at McDonald's. Okay. First job ever, McDonald's. I spent a lot of time.
In Sweden, everybody.
Oh, yeah. Right? Even in Sweden. I spent, I don't know, it was close to 2 years at McDonald's.
Wow.
Yep.
Usually it's like 6 months. I got to get out of here. You put your time.
It was had some extra cash in my pocket. It was great.
Okay, good for you.
I'd kind of developed a little bit more of an interest in food and maybe not wine as much, but me and my group of peers in at university, we'd cook, we'd find excuses to throw dinners, and it was probably more beer and whiskey at the time, but wine was certainly involved at the time. You know, the college age is a lot more fluid in Europe, so, and I got in very young, so many of my peers were 2, 3, 4, 5 years older than me and probably had like better tastes and we're old enough to go buy booze too, which is a huge thing.
Yeah, different there. Yeah. So when does the restaurant stuff happen? You know, when do you actually getting in and working?
So I for like proper restaurants and not your McDonald's or kind of lunch type restaurants, I started working sort of after I went on that break, really. A friend of mine got me a job at a wine shop, really. That was my first real exposure to like better wine. So that was started out as a sort of a summer hiatus gig, and I immediately sort of got hooked. I realized that people were going to come in and ask questions and expect me to have answers.
You like that?
I like that, and it really made me. I found it fascinating, and I realized that it sort of satisfied my nerdy book study side and the sort of service side. And I liked what was in the glass too. So I began bringing bottles home and began reading about different things just so I could field some of the questions. And I did that for a while. And then one of my good colleagues at that place really, really said, like, after I'd spent, I think, a year there or a little more, a year and a half, maybe, was like, hey, if you're serious about this thing, if you really, you're like, you're good about wine, but you got to get, if you want to do this, if you want to gain the experience and the tasting database of someone who's going to be good at this, you need to go work as a sommelier. So you need to like make that your goal. And I was like, all right, I'll give it a shot.
Like a real restaurant.
Yeah,
type
like
thing.
A real restaurant, which there wasn't that many of where I was. So, okay. So I moved and I started, I actually studied to become a sommelier and worked, took any opportunity I could to work in better restaurants, and I worked a whole bunch of sort of events, projects, and private dining, and
this is all still in the south of Sweden, right?
Well, or my studies were further north,
okay.
But I would
still
I
in
would,
the country,
yeah. So okay. I spent, but I did get into
a really great little Italian restaurant in Copenhagen, sort of on a whim. And this was at the time, and still is, a one Michelin star, fancy little cool place that had a massive Italian wine list.
Looking back now, a good one?
Yeah, I'd say so. At least
more Barolo than Tuscany.
More Tuscany. They were sort of Umbrian-based family, so their heart was more in the central Italian sort of style. And they, you know, I started as a busser and a runner, and I learned my way sort of slowly throughout the months of, I got more and more stuff to do with the wine program, which was great.
Nice.
So that was really the beginning of it. And then relocated to Stockholm and got my first job as a sommelier in, I would say,
what year are we talking?
This would be 2007. No.
Okay.
Yeah. 2007.
Not that long ago.
I know.
You know, when we get to where you are now, I mean, that's not that long ago.
Yeah, it's been intense.
All right, so get us from there to the present.
Well, I mean, there's a lot. It's like a parallel story here. Like, one is my restaurant career, and at the same time, sort of the competition career, which started happening sort of at the same time. So while I was working,
good point.
It was never like a dream of mine, in a way. While I had, you know, I kind of thought of it as a not a silly thing, but of such a niche thing to sort of compete as a sommelier. I was much more about doing the actual sort of work in a restaurant, and I loved that. But when I got to Stockholm and started working there, I sort of shared the job title with this guy who's a friend of mine, but he was competing for the best title of the best sommelier of Sweden. And seeing as we sort of shared the job, I was like, I can at least beat this guy. That was more of sort of a friendly rivalry.
So that's
rivalry.
When your ball started growing, yeah. And you said, I could do this.
Yeah, I was helping.
Plus, I want to smack this bastard.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So I was helping him train, and like halfway there, I was like, let me try this. And I did pretty well. I didn't win that year, but I got far.
Wait. Yeah. You did better than just not win. I mean, weren't you the runner-up?
I was the runner-up, and that was kind of a shock. But
you
I
were
realized,
surprised?
Yeah, okay. It was not supposed to be that quick. But you know, the what I immediately realized was that even if the competitions are really tough and can seem kind of esoteric and niche, it was a way for me to sort of force myself to keep growing and learning and studying, because I could see that. And I still see it's very easy for people once they land that job title. All right, now I'm a sommelier, or now I'm a wine director. Then your sort of growth tends to stifle a little bit. A, you're caught up in the work, but also you're like, you've reached the goal. What point of it is there for me to learn about, you know, these wines that I might not have any sort of personal interest in, or I'm not going to be buying?
Right.
So this was a way for me to force myself to not get stuck in that trap. And yeah.
So you runner up in that competition, mm-hmm. and you alluded that the competition thing ran parallel to work. And so
right.
what
so
happened?
This was now in 2008, beginning of 2009, sort of really just right after the financial sort of meltdown. Due to some other factors, namely the difficulty of buying or finding an apartment at that point in that financial climate, me and my girlfriend at the time had to relocate, and we moved back to the south of Sweden, and I moved back to work in Copenhagen. I kind of missed that scene. It was a much more mature restaurant and wine scene at the time. So we relocated for me to work in Copenhagen, and I kept on. I also realized that I would be, you know, I'd finished runner up in that competition. I realized that, hey, this is, I can do this. I can figure this out. I think I can figure out what they're looking for and dial that in and keep studying and being a huge nerd. I thought I can really do this.
Competition comes next?
Next up comes Best Sommelier of Sweden, and then Best Sommelier of the Nordic countries, so Denmark, Sweden.
And what happened with those?
I won both. So okay. that was
no runner-up, first time in, yeah, walk out with the medals
much,
and all of
much,
that.
Yeah.
So what does that do? Does that make you a hotter property in Scandinavia, or does that convince you I got to get out of here?
No, that definitely. It took me a long time to figure that part out. But no, that definitely opened up some doors, and. Yeah, like I said, parallel to again, sort of switching back and forth, but in that sort of financial climate, I also realized that, because I moved to Copenhagen to work for a really fancy restaurant, and at the time, they did not survive that climate. So at the same time, I
shut down.
Yeah, they shut down. They're reopened again now and are doing really well, but they didn't do well at that point. So my sort of fine dining dreams, which is what I thought I would be doing and what I sort of had done up until that point, were kind of, you know, put on pause. And I took a job as a sort of wine director or head sommelier or something of that nature for a much different restaurant, a bigger operation, a very well-respected group of people who opened up a steakhouse, sort of an American-style sort of exclusive steakhouse in Copenhagen.
A lot of Cabernet.
It was a lot of Cabernet, for sure, yeah. And but it was a massive success, and it was a lot of different things, too. These were guys that were chefs and sommeliers. Who
what
started.
Year are we at now?
This is 2009.
Nine, so it's still right.
Yeah, still early. But I realized then in that environment how much more I thrived on, you know, working with a wine list and selling bottles as opposed to working with a sort of a set tasting menu and wine.
You're starting
pairing.
To feel what's important
yeah,
to you.
Yeah, I remember like one of those first days when we just opened, and it was painful. Like I it was so. It was like I did cry multiple nights out of in that opening. Okay. We were so crushed. But terrible. I had this little shelf where I kept the little tasting glasses of everything that I opened and. It was just like multiple bottles. I had two different wines from DRC.
Amazing
and some
stuff.
Like old Gaia and Russo and some Cabernet too.
That's
you
the
know?
Trade-off.
It was just like
you get stuck
shit.
In that yeah. environment, but you
but
get
all,
to
yeah, exactly. So yeah. all of a sudden, I was in a fast-paced, a la carte restaurant, but selling really great bottles of wine and buying great bottles of wine, and that grew. It was such a huge success, even in that economic sort of climate, that turned into a restaurant group. And within sort of the next 5 years, I grew with them and ended up being the
so big chunk of time there.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So
exactly.
into the early teens.
Yeah.
So now what happens?
So
I mean, you're here in the States. So
yeah.
You gotta, you know, we gotta finish up here. Get me to the States.
I gotta finish up the background. Shortly, what happened was I took over buying for that entire group of restaurants. I'm buying for 8 restaurants at the very end.
She basically rose to the top.
Yeah.
On the
yeah, with
beverage
that, with
and
that
wine
job.
Side.
So it was an amazing opportunity. And the wine programs were all serious. So I was spending a lot of time traveling, a lot of time meeting winemakers, a lot of time
all
buying wine.
All the good
wine.
That goes
yeah.
with a program.
So that was good.
You were wrapped in.
But at the same time, I was getting to a point where I was, again, sort of in behind a computer screen. Both like bored and stressed with my life at the same time. You're like stuck in email hell and with a spreadsheet more than you are with guests and wine at that point too, even though you're...
Sure.
Yeah. So I had gained a lot of great contacts in the world of wine and I was meeting with all the producers, but I wasn't selling that much personally anymore and wasn't talking to the guests anymore, which I missed a lot. So I felt like I had to step down really. I was 29 at the time.
That's it?
Yeah. Shit. So I felt like this has gone... This had moved too fast. At the same time, I'd won the best sommelier in Europe, so everything was sort of so high paced and intense that I felt like I needed to work in a restaurant again. I need to get back on the restaurant floor. I need to say, you know, turn this great job that I have down and go do something simpler.
What's important to you?
Yeah,
you know, sort of your roots.
Right.
So where does that lead you?
So through one of those real spiders in the web of the wine world, the guy we both know, Rajat Par. I was
absolutely the best, the sweetheart.
Yeah.
So there's a guy, and I'm not rubbing this in your face. Yeah. You don't have to win any goddamn competitions to know a bottle of wine. We
exactly.
agree on that, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, you and him are like the perfect, you know, match.
No, that's absolutely
right, so
true.
So what impact does Raj have on you? Right.
So Raj was just a guy that would, I would see a lot. Just he'd come to Copenhagen where I was. I'd see him in just kind of around the wine world. In California, I'd see him for various things in London or whatever. And... he introduced me. He'd do the sort of gastronomic tours in Scandinavia at the time, where he'd bring a bunch of people along, and I went on a couple of those. We'd end up at Fäviken in Sweden and spend some time in Stockholm and Copenhagen, that kind of thing. I traveled with a couple of French winemakers, and then we all met up in Stockholm, and part of the crew that was then going to spend 4 or 5 days together was, besides Raj, was Robert Bohr, who is now my sort of partner at Legacy Records. So we really just, this was in the end of 2014.
That's your connection to Robert?
Exactly. There. So we had a lot of friends.
To that point, was a prolific wine guy.
Right. We had a lot of friends in common, and we knew of each other. We never met up until that point. But we realized on during that short week that we had a lot in common. We like believed in the same style of service. We liked the same kind of wine. We liked the same kind of music. We just clicked really well. And I was at the time, I was getting bored with my job, and I kind of expressed that to this group of people. And I was entertaining some different things around Europe, because you don't kind of step down from that kind of job that I had to go. It's like you have to go in exile a little bit.
Right, leave the country.
Yeah, but I remember this vividly. We were at Fäviken, and these guys were like, "You got to go to New York. That's the place to be, and that's like really the center of the wine world." And,
were
and
you open to that? Like you, that?
Well,
intrigued
I had
you?
Never, I'd never thought about it before. It wasn't.
But
the
after
dream of
that,
mine. Yeah, I remember calling my today wife, then girlfriend, and being like, "Hey, how about New York?" And she was like, "All right, let's
how
do it."
How quickly after that?
Well, I don't know if I should. Yeah. Well, we were. I was there very quickly after. I was there a couple of weeks after.
Okay, we don't have to get into
that.
Yeah. So you come. Robert gets you to come over to Charlie Bird,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And then I come back. I was
it just Charlie Bird in those days, or was Pasquale?
It was just Charlie Bird in those days. And I come back. The first week that I start was the week of the sort of the Palais wine madness, the Burgundy celebration. So that was my first week in New York at Charlie Bird, and I was like. You were opening so many legendary bottles of wine, but
crazy.
It was, you know, the late nights and
you didn't work
painfully,
La Follet, did you?
I did.
You
yeah,
did.
Yeah.
You did.
Painfully hard, and I was like, is this what it is? Is this what the city's like? I don't know if I can like keep this up. It's amazing, but I don't know if I can keep doing this.
You're here.
Yeah.
What?
Great.
So you're at Charlie Bird. Let's finish up. Mm. You're at Charlie Bird. How long? And then you moved to Legacy when?
I was at Charlie Bird, I guess, for. If I started in early 2015 and I ended in late 2017, so 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you go over to their newest opening, Legacy Records, mm-hmm. which we'll talk about in a few minutes.
Yeah.
We'll jump back to that.
Exactly. We'll jump back to the competition.
Too. As I mentioned, you know, Arvid laid out his sort of competition schedule through his career. But the reality is Arvid was the reigning best sommelier in the world, which he won in 2016, and it's a every three-year contest. So he just relinquished his title the end of last year. So he was the reigning best sommelier. So Arvid, what I want to talk about is that's got to be one of the most intense competitions. What's the best sommelier competition in the world? I mean, what is that? Is that the top of it? And then let's talk about the competition itself,
right.
Prep and all of that.
I mean, you can discuss, there are various, you know, you can talk about the Court of Master Sommeliers and all that. I think the competition puts that to, that's that on steroids. You're basically, like you said, it's a competition that's held every 3 years. The people that get to go to this competition are selected to represent their country, or they've won one of the sort of best of Europe or best of Americas or best of
It's kind of like the golf thing. To get in the best tournament,
right,
the Masters,
yeah.
you have to be a winner of something else.
So there's roughly 60 people, each representing their home country, each the best of who, you know, their selective country, competing for this title. And there are a bunch of people who are master sommeliers and even a master of wine at some point, and there's a bunch of great people competing for this title. And what it basically is the same kind of thing. Like if you've seen the Somme movie, you've seen
the elements
sort
of what it takes.
Yeah, the elements are more or less the same. They're a little different in the way that this is sort of more audience facing, and it's more geared towards. I wouldn't say that it's showier, but it's a bigger, for example, when you're doing a blind tasting, you're standing up in front of a jury. And if you get to the finals, you're standing up in front of cameras and an audience.
Right.
Yeah. So
if you've seen some, yeah. you're always in a small room, yeah. even the service yeah, parts. This is down. In a theater.
Yeah. So you got to like ramp up the charm a little wow. bit, I think.
That's got to be nerve-wracking.
It is, absolutely. So, yeah, you're judged on theory, and that, of course, becomes super granular, very esoteric knowledge about everything in the world of wine, spirits,
Maddingly
sake,
esoteric, as you
beer.
Said.
Oh, yeah. I've forgotten a lot of it already, even a couple of years later. It's like, if you don't... I would wake up every morning and spend an hour or two just repetition of knowledge that I had
but
to
that's,
like put on.
That's yeah. human nature. Oh, you know, you prepare. Yeah. But talk to me about the prep yeah. thing. I mean, in reality, to prep for this, how far back and how long were you focused
well,
on this?
It was an ongoing process. Like so, from
the other competition.
Yeah. So there was always like the next target. But I would say, you know, I spent 7 years on this, and
7 years. What every day?
Well, I mean, it comes and goes in waves. I would say the last three, or really the last four, I knew that I was going to be competing for the best of the world, and I ramped it up, and I laid it out, and I studied how to study, and I studied then a lot. And it's not just, you know, so what I would do is I would spend a lot of time reading and trying to, you know, eke out the facts from books or, you know, sketchy websites or whatever it is, and then, you know, to really memorize all that, I would wake up every morning and do a lot of repetition and flashcards and all that nonsense. Blind tasting.
So you'd
is
spend
huge.
A few hours a day.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
for the last 2-3 years, you're saying, oh, yeah. you your head
of,
was down.
Thousands of hours. Yeah.
For sure.
And
nothing less would have worked, right?
No. Absolutely not. Like the most, you know, the two predecessors that won this title before me spent, you know, they were in their close to or in their 50s when they won. They spent 20 years between winning the best of their country and then trying again and again and again to get to the title.
But that,
of,
you know, that's your competitive best. Spirit that you talk
yeah,
about.
Yeah, I think I identified sort of along the way that I would do it at a very, I would do it within high intensity and get in and get out. And I would have, if I hadn't won in 2016, I wouldn't have done it again. I knew that was
my last
shot.
You know, I was
going to
ask you that. It almost sounds like as you get older, it's just harder as far as distractions, maybe a kid, a marriage, job.
Absolutely.
I don't think your brain is as intensely fresh, you know.
I could never do it again.
Right. You caught the window on all of that. You said there were three elements to it. Yeah. Just buzz through them quickly. Theoretical,
theory,
blind tasting.
Blind tasting and then service tasks.
So theory is all the facts about wine.
Theories, all the facts about wine. But
everything, right?
Pretty much everything. Pretty much everything that can be put down on paper. But it also extends to spirits and beer and sake and cigars and everything that can
you
be remotely related to the work.
You have to know how to light a cigar and
you
have to know sake.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Crazy.
And
so that's the theory, knowing everything about all of those topics. Mm-hmm. Blind tasting is what it sounds like.
Blind tasting is what it sounds like.
You sit down.
Sit down. I would, in preparation for that, I would, you know, go around the city. People like Pascaline here in the city. And
tasting groups.
Michael Engelman, and I had a tasting group going on, would be instrumental in just like every week putting down a couple of things for me or making me do it at restaurant lineup. I did that at you know, Michael helped me out at the Moderns. So
right.
I stood up in front of the whole team and did blind tastings and that kind of thing. So, and then...
How many, for this specific test...
Uh-huh.
For this specific test, how many wines did you have to blind taste?
Right. The competitions is over several days.
Oh,
so
okay.
I would say, I can't remember specifically, but I think first day you'd taste two wines and then multiple spirits or beverages, just identification of those. And then it ramps up so that, you know, and on day two, when they've narrowed it down to 12 candidates, there'd been longer tastings. And then on stage for the final, when there's only three left, I can't remember how many tastings there were, but there were a couple of quick ones, just
right.
like pure identification. What's this, and how does it relate to these
right.
others? And then there's at least one or two longer tell us everything about this wine and how will you use it and how would you serve it. And
it sounds more frenetic than the MS test, you know, because like you said, you're on the stage multiple days.
Well, there is that. I mean, and that also, like, the further you get, the more service elements take over. And on the final stage, they would essentially, like, you'd have various tables.
This so is like a service
mock,
part.
Yeah, it's a mock restaurant.
Like how you would serve a customer.
Yeah,
in the
and they would tell you like, hey, this table wants to or needs a bottle, a magnum of red decanted, and these guys over here need a bottle of champagne served. Over here, they need wine recommendations with a vegetarian menu, etc. And then they'll trip you up along the way.
So it's a simulation.
Yeah.
And you realized it was all about trying to bust your balls and how you held
exactly.
up, right?
Yeah,
pretty
yeah.
much.
So it's a part of preparation too. I spent, to be in a good mindset or mind stage when once you got up that far. I spent time with an acting coach.
Wow.
I meditated every day for a year. Yeah.
Zen and feng shui.
Exactly. Well, it's just, I'm not a natural, I don't like being in front of people.
So you had to work
towards
it. I get
nervous. So I had to figure out a way to shed that and be ready to go once the lights are on. You know?
It's amazing you say that and that you accomplished that. I mean, kudos to you for one, doing it and winning it, but realizing it and doing what you needed. Arvid, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I have a few more questions about the World's Best Sommelier Competition. I want to talk about the wine program at Legacy. I want to get your take on a few things on wine. Then I want to subject you to our wine list, and then we're going to taste a little wine. We're talking to Arvid Rosengren from Legacy Records, the world's best sommelier. This is Sam Ben Ruby. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be back in just a few.
Cool.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of Swiss Gruyere into the United States, but that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kotbock cave-aged cheeses, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Allison Kane, and I'm the host of In the Sauce here on HRN. Now that I'm expanding my cooking school to a sauce line in grocery stores, I need all the help I can get. And I want to help other entrepreneurs build their brands too. You can find In the Sauce wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Arvid Rosengren. Arvid is a partner and wine director at Legacy Records, part of the Delicious Hospitality Group. Arvid just turned his title of best sommelier in the world over to some German guy. We won't even mention his name.
Yeah, I didn't lose it. I just
I didn't. Did I say you lost
no,
it?
No, I'm kidding.
No. Every 3 years, you didn't compete in that. So answer this question quickly, because I want to get into wine and legacy and all of that. Now that you're moving away from being the best sommelier in the world, how has all this affected what direction you want to go in? And, does it change your life, or you have your course set up?
Well, I would say that after winning that title, it was a real moment for me of reflection. And I'd been on such an autopilot path getting there that I had to sort of sit down and think, what do I do with my life now? And a lot of people who do that kind of thing, like have won that title in the past, or the same thing happens to people who become MSs. The first step is they get out of the restaurant business. They stop being sommeliers.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty prevalent. And I think I could have spent my time at that point, being a flying wine consultant of some sort.
Right.
And, that has its pros. But I thought – you know, I had this great opportunity to open a restaurant and really shape the direction of that. And
you said earlier you like that.
I love
you
it.
You like being on the floor. I love being on the floor. Interacting with people.
It's stressful, but it's also strangely meditative. It's like it's immediate stress. It's stuff you can get over. It's not existential stress.
Right.
So I also realized that having something like that with my sort of name on it, a legacy record, or it's sort of a physical business card. You know, it's my legacy, if you will.
It's and really you're where you want to be.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I think I'll be doing this for a while.
Everything progressed the way you want it.
Right.
You know, what's ironic to me in talking to you a little and looking into the world's best Psalm competition, it seems a little stuffy. You know, you're wearing like tuxedos and all that. And your restaurant and even the Delicious Group is sort of the epitome of how you do casual dining.
Yeah.
And it's done well.
I think you're right. I think at the time when I was competing, I really didn't think that the primarily old French guys that are judging this competition would sort of accept that. And I think I was definitely the first one to win. I was at Charlie Ritt at the time, so I was you know, working in a much different environment, at very different restaurants to what those guys judge to be a good restaurant.
Totally.
But having gotten to know them now after the fact and having judged competitions with them, I think everyone was ready for that. Everyone was ready for some sort of change in terms of what's accepted. And I'm happy that I could, you know, we're by far not the first restaurant to sell good wine in a casual environment,
no.
but I think I can at least, I'm happy to have been like an ambassador for that in that part of
the wine world. Do you think that's the wave where dining is going? That's the good model right now. You don't want to spend multi-millions for a fancy place. Is that what the market wants, whether it's millennials or...
You know, Legacy Records is not a wholly like unfancy restaurant, but I will say that as a whole...
I didn't imply that.
Yeah. No, but I think in general, I think the making people feel comfortable and at home and welcome is the zeitgeist that we're in, and I'm wholeheartedly behind that.
So that's a hospitality mission.
Yeah, that's a hospitality mission.
Let's morph into wine. What's the wine mission?
The wine mission.
What do you want to accomplish?
Yeah. Well, I think it's the same. It's on that same thing. I think you don't necessarily have to equate, you know, Michelin stars with good wine programs or you know that whole thing. Just I think it might be a millennial thing, but we see the aging banker types also loving Charlie Bird or Legacy Records, having a place where they can take their ties off and relax and still drink great bottles of wine and enjoy great food, but not have it be in a stuffy environment. I think that's huge.
So talk to me about the actual wine. What you're telling me is, for that guy, you better have a good lineup of some of the classics. And for other people, you got to go the other way, which may be biodynamic or new regions and all that and everything. Is that what you're accomplishing?
I think so. I mean, maybe not everyone agrees, but I think what we did at Charlie Bird and what we keep doing at Legacy Records is, you know, firmly rooted in sort of the classic regions of Europe, mainly because we have a good access to it. So we can.
If you had to list the 3-4 classic regions, so people know you're.
And we're talking about Burgundy in France. We're talking about Champagne, the Rhone Valley, Barolo Barbaresco, German Riesling, Bordeaux, you know, those are the classics. Tuscany, etc. Things that are recognizable, that people understand inherently. And, you know, there are various levels of value within those regions. Unfortunately, if you want to get the best wines of those places, they're expensive.
Right.
So I look, and the world of wine is like never moved faster. And I think there's great wine coming out of everywhere. So
what are some of... I have this question written down. Good time. What are some of the either up and coming or good value or interesting wine regions? One that you like, and ultimately that probably brings it onto the list.
Right.
Give me some areas.
I think I've been a champion of sort of new wave Spanish wine for close to a decade. You probably can't say that's up and coming anymore. But every time I go to Spain, there's I think I have a good grasp on Spanish wine. Every time I go, I taste and see labels that I've never heard of before, or never seen before. It's moving. It's a very dynamic scene.
Are we talking like Catalonia or even the old Rioja, Ribera? You know, what are we talking about?
Pretty much all of it. For me, the love started in the Northwest, sort of Galicia, the Basque Country. I used to go there a lot when I lived in Europe. Catalonia is the same thing. It took a little longer to catch on, but they're on fire right now. There's a bunch of great wine coming out of that. But you see the great wine coming out of the south too, and central Spain, like the high altitude red wines that are coming out.
And those wines are amazing. Some of those wines are featured on the list.
Absolutely.
That's your imprint, at least right?
That's it. But you know, when it comes to, we're seeing great wines coming out of places like Hungary and closer to home, places like Santa Barbara right now. The wines that are coming out of that area are for the most part, I think, the most exciting from California at this point.
So how, I almost ask this question to everybody, how do natural wines play into your wine list? And natural wine's a broad category, but I think we understand, you know, what the broadness is. And then I want your thoughts on natural wines and the natural wine movement.
Right. I have a lot of thoughts. And I had a lot of thoughts. There's an article or a blog post that I wrote back in, I think, 2012 or 13.
Wow.
Still gets passed around and gets sort of rehashed once in a while, and I get 100 comments on Facebook, angry or supportive.
Right.
But natural wine plays a part in the sense that I support the goals of that movement. I think it's had a massively positive benefit on the world of wine in the way that it's made conventional producers, more than anything, think about their practices. And we're seeing, pretty big famous names in places like, Bordeaux, which we thought unthinkable a few years ago, are now certified biodynamic and making wines with its, lower levels, at least, of interventions and sulfur and additives, which is huge. So they made producers think about what they were doing, and that's good. I conversely think that there's a lot of terrible wine being sold as natural wine.
Would you agree there's terrible wine being sold not as natural wine too?
Of course, yeah. It's rarely being heralded as a good thing. Like industrial conventional wine is terrible and everyone knows it.
True. That's a very good specific point.
Right. I think unfortunately, so here's here's what I love about the natural wine movement. A, what I said before, that they made producers think about what we're doing. B, that they're bringing a crowd of people in who would otherwise not be excited about wine. People who would be drinking
we
beer.
Love that.
That's huge. And some of those people are gonna be drinking natural wine forever, but some of them are gonna be drinking just good wine. And I think that's my point. I love natural wine when it's good. I don't make it a point to buy natural wine solely for our list.
Right.
But if it's good, and of course, the less stuff you put in a bottle and the less stuff you put in a vineyard, more than anything, is huge. That said, am I going to blame the producer in a place like, the wine we're drinking now, or a place like, the Nantes in the Loire Valley, where it happens to rain a lot? If they have to spray one year because they're going to lose their crop, I'm not going to not buy their wine. I think that's not my role as a buyer. You have to be loyal and you have to support good producers too.
Well, that's a good point because you have to react to the geographic and climate conditions.
It's very easy to
But the Loire is one of the places that's ground zero for natural wine.
Yeah, if you're in southern Sicily, it's really easy to be natural.
Yeah.
If you're in a place like Bordeaux, it's really tough.
Well, those are some good thoughts, and you do have natural wines on the list, and we're going to taste one in a minute.
If I can add one more point, one thing what I wrote all the way back then, and what I think is still true, is that I think it's a little dangerous for young professionals in in the sort of natural, it's easy to get caught up in that movement. It's fun, it's interesting, but there are still some very sort of dogmatic voices that sort of put things ahead. And I saw this when I was in Copenhagen at the time, where every new restaurant that opened was natural.
Pretty
was
good very, movement there pretty early good movement, on.
Very
so
strong
you were
movement.
Around it.
And it's kind of backed off a little bit. If you look at places like Noma at this point, their list is a lot more, not more conventional, but I think...
Really?
You know, you've started seeing sort of a delineation that not everything that's natural is good. And what I was getting to is that I think it's important if you're an up-and-coming sommelier, to take the chances to not discredit entire regions. Or like, I'm tired of hearing things like, you know, there's no good Bordeaux. There's right. no, you know, Cabernet's a shit grape. You know, like, people say stuff like that. And
right.
It's ridiculous.
I agree.
So you have to taste with an open mind, whether it's one way or the other, whether you think you're against natural wine or you're only for natural wine. Oh, anyway, everyone should have an open mind tasting.
I agree with that. And those are really some good thoughts and some good points.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you put them out there. Answer this question quickly, and then I want to go to the wine list. Is it harder to put a smaller condensed wine list together, you know, a la Charlie Bird?
I think it's a lot harder.
Than like Cedric Niquet's at 11 Madison.
Yeah. I mean, Cedric does a great job. And for him, it's about sourcing and always having those wines that his clients need
but is
available.
Is it still harder to do the smallest?
I think it is. It's harder to find the balance. It's hard to find
balance.
Balance
is what else?
Between prices, between regions. I expanded the list at Legacy. It's still small, I think. It's a couple of it's.
But
whatever,
is there a rule
pages.
There? Like, is it too big for anyone? Do you want it to be under a certain amount of bottles?
No, I think it's big enough. Charlie Bird was maybe not too small, but
you
what
wanted
happened
it to
at
fit
Charlie
on
Bird,
that page, though, right?
You have to fit it on the page. Yeah. That's one thing. The second thing is, and this is at Charlie Bird, it was hard to be creative. If I wanted to list, if I tasted something great from Hungary or Slovenia, or it was you'd list that at the expense of a Chablis.
More
which
leeway
is not,
here,
you know. Then you're
right.
You got to strike the balance also between servicing your guest and your business, right? So, I think I found a good balance at Legacy. It's enough of the classics and the sort of benchmarks, with enough room for spice in terms
well,
of
you,
exciting
you gotta work
things.
Towards
yeah.
that.
But stuff you got to talk about and sell, hand sell.
Yeah,
yeah.
I thought that would be the case. Mm. All right, Arvid, we have a thing called the wine list. We ask all our guests 5 questions. We post them on social media. We got a database of the greatest people in wine and what they've been drinking.
All
Maybe
right.
one day I'll make a movie or a book. But for now, let's buzz through this. First question is, what are you drinking now? Not this Vino Verde, but are you drinking seasonal? Are you tasting a region for the restaurant? Is there something intriguing you in the fridge?
What have I been drinking recently? It should just be a quick answer. I have been drinking a lot of Austrian wine lately.
Okay.
Yeah. I did
non-Gruner?
Non-Gruner. I have been, this is very
give me
untrendy.
One or two things you're drinking
been,
and maybe give
yeah,
me a maker.
I've been drinking a lot of great Sauvignon Blanc from Styria lately, which
okay.
is, Sauvignon Blanc is not my favorite grape, but
okay.
I found some things that really...
Do you like the Austrian Sauvignons?
Absolutely, yeah.
Like better than the fact that you don't love Sauvignon?
Yeah, I'd say
okay.
so, yeah.
All right, so that's a good
something
one.
About that. That's interesting.
That's a good one. Mm-hmm. This is the goofiest question on the list, but do you have a favorite wine and food pairing? Is there something, it doesn't mean you eat it every night, but something that resonates with you or when you did it, oh wow, or if you could do it?
You know, I'm a sucker for really simple things, so like...
Wait, we have a rule here. You can't say champagne and oysters.
No, not
so.
Not
give me
that,
something besides.
But sort of roast chicken and a good white burgundy.
All right, so in your mind... A really well-made roast chicken just goes great with a white burgundy.
Yeah.
Now, are we talking Puligny, Montrachet? What are we talking?
Probably talking Meursault more than anything.
Meursault,
but,
okay.
You know, it's more up to the producer at this point than anything
okay,
else.
Okay, so that's a good one.
Yeah.
A nice Zuni chicken in San Francisco.
Exactly.
With it. All right. Your favorite restaurant and or wine bar. I'm going to put you in New York. Mm-hmm. I know you've traveled a lot and all that. And sometimes it's a tough question because I don't want you to leave anybody out, feel like it's exclusive. But who's doing it well? Like when you go there, they got the selection, they got the environment, they got the knowledge. Can you think of a few places?
I'll name a couple. If I want to do a fancy meal, I think, probably the best food in the city is Brooklyn Fare, I'd say. I love that place.
Yeah.
But, you know, as far as a good restaurant as a whole combination, the Modern does an amazing
Michael
job.
Michael comes up many times.
As far as a great place where I feel really comfortable bringing my one-year-old daughter and I'll know I'll eat well and drink well, Racine is a great place.
Pascaline.
Pascaline and Arnaud do a great job.
You know, it's funny, like Jordan Salcido is always at Charlie Bird with her kid.
Yeah.
What you're describing, you know, a glass of wine and a pizza or whatever.
Exactly.
Those are good ones. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite all-time wine? And I get so redundant, but it used to be the rarest or most expensive. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's that, but a lot of times it became experiential. You know, we had a Solos when we got engaged and blah, blah.
You know, I've had a...
I've tasted a lot of good wine. But what's important to you?
Probably the greatest wine experience that I've had, and this wine is not always great. It's a fancy bottle of wine, but it's unfortunately not always great. Is Chave Hermitage 78. I had in the cellar, and Jean-Louis's father, Gerard, served it. He made that wine. He served it. It's one of the greatest bottles of wine. Probably the greatest taste of wine I've ever had.
Was 78 considered a killer year?
It's good.
It wasn't necessarily.
No, it's a great wine.
It was great. Yeah. Okay.
Problem is the bottles of these days, who knows, storing, shippage, etc., are not always.
So 78.
They're not always on point.
A 78 Chave Hermitage.
But I'll a counterpoint wine that I have always in my fridge is a good Fino. I'm like an Innocente Fino. It's maybe the greatest value wine out there, and I love
What is Fino?
Fino is a sherry. So
that's what I thought.
Biological
sherry. So
sherry,
Fino, which is a type of sherry.
Yeah.
And what'd you say, Innocente?
Yeah,
Fino Innocente. Is that the maker or is that the type?
It's a brand from Valdespino.
Okay,
I-N-N. It's I-N-O-C-A-N-T-E.
Okay, I'm going to post that.
Yeah, I don't so much, it's not food and wine pairing. For me, it's food and cooking pairing.
No. That's a favorite wine of yours. You like that.
Yeah.
All right, last wine, and you should be able to do this.
Okay.
I ask everybody the best wine around $15-$20 retail.
Yeah.
Because my kids are too embarrassed to bring a $9 bottle to a party, and they can't afford $40, but they want to be ballers and bring something cool. So $15-$20 retail. Give me a red. Give me a white. It could be like a category Muscadet. It could be a maker. Yeah.
Well,
what comes to mind?
The Fino Sherry that I mentioned. If you like that kind of thing, and you should. Should at least try it. That's there. That's fantastic value. The wine that we're having is one of those for sure too.
So for the white, just say what it is quickly, and we're going to.
So we're drinking a Vinho Verde
from
north of Portugal,
right?
Based on the grape Loureiro, producers Afros.
Okay, A P H R O S.
Yeah.
Afros.
All right, Muscadet is a good bet. I mean, there's
Muscadet
few regions
for white.
That,
give me a red.
You right now look for Spanish Garnacha from places like Madrid or Sierra de Gredos.
And you'll find them for $15-$20.
You can find them for maybe
so Spanish Garnacha.
Yeah.
Which is the Grenache grape?
It's the should be the Grenache grape. It's the Grenache grape.
Those are good recos. Yeah. And like I said, we'll post those on social media. I'll spell everything out for you. Mm-hmm. All right, Arvid, we have 3 minutes to talk about this wine.
Yeah.
Every week we taste a different wine on air for our weekly wine sip. This week we're tasting the 2016 Afros Vino Verde. Just quickly tell me about this wine.
Yeah, so this producer... is in the north of Portugal, a region called Minho.
Which is really where most of the whites are made, north of Portugal.
Yeah, exactly. It's a much different place, just like the northwest of Spain. I mean, this is the extension of that. Much greener, much lusher. It rains a lot. Still warm, but it rains a lot. So the wines are very different from the rest of the country. And as I was mentioning, this is, to me, a great example of how inexpensive wine doesn't have to be sort of unsustainable or unconscientious and and industrially made.
You said this is biodynamic.
This is biodynamic, which is really very tough to make in that sort of climate. You know,
right.
That's what I was saying, in a place where it rains a lot. This means that they put in actual work to make this happen. This is also made in, you know, it's not a minor quantity. The back label that I'm looking at says 24,666 bottles made. So it's not an industrial product.
There's some accessibility to it.
Absolutely. And you'll find this in wine shops from, you know, $16 to $20, I would say. This guy makes a lot of different wine. He's kind of a... this one is clean.
So look
and
for
fresh.
Afros besides this particular
exactly.
wine.
So there are
basically across the board.
There are some Petnats and there's an orange wine cool. and they're not, you'll have to taste and see what you like. This one is a clean Loureiro, which
all right,
I
let's
love.
Do a quick evaluation.
Yeah.
So color, there's kind of a deeper yellowish. It's not,
I would say so,
it's
yeah.
not that pale.
Yeah.
I mean, there's
not,
some color there.
It's clear, but it's got
Give
a little bit of color.
Give me your nose descriptors.
So this is not quite. I mean, it's ripe fruit, definitely. Ripe fruit. There's like riper sort of orchard fruit, sort of kind of a bitter citrus note, sort of a kumquat, grapefruit kind of thing going on.
Kumquat's a good one because there's intensity.
But it's not all about the fruit. This is kind of, to me, mineral, and it's kind of herbal in a full way. The palate is fresh.
Wait, before the palate, the mouthfeel is medium. Mm-hmm. It's not a thin wine. It's not too unctuous, but it's pretty full, right?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, now give me the palate. Does the palate reflect the nose in any way?
I think so. And I don't want to get too far deep into like fruit salad wine descriptions. I think it's more important, like you said, talk about the structure. It's got some density, but it's got a good acidic kick to it too. Good. It's not the lightest wine in the world. It's a good sort of all...
Good point. Density, acidity makes it. So what foods would we pair this with?
Really any kind of seafood. Keep it simple. Keep it clean. Put some octopus on the grill.
That's a good one.
You know, throw some capers or something a little bitter
Don't
in there.
Be afraid
some bitter
to
greens.
Put something. Yeah.
That'll do well.
All right. So I will post the 2016 Afros. I'll give you more information, maybe even a picture of the bottle. All right, Arvid, we got to wrap up. Time went by pretty quickly. We could talk about a lot more, and maybe we will down the road. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. Also, subscribe to The Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Like I said, we will post Arvid's wine list answers. We'll post the weekly wine sip wine and any other wines of interest that he mentioned. Arvid, if we want to find more about you and Legacy on social, where do we go?
LegacyRecordsNYC.com, I believe.
Okay.
I'm my name at everything, so at Arvid Rosengren.
ArvidRosengren.
Exactly.
Right?
I'm glad you did. I'm terrible at spelling.
Okay.
But there's only
You're
one
pretty
of
good
me,
at
so.
Everything else. All right. Thank you to our guest, Arvid Rosengren. Thank you to our engineers at Heritage and Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.